Welcome to the computer vision class. In the last 2 weeks, we talked about some foundations. So maybe most notably, okay, what are frequencies? How are images represented? How are colors represented? I would say these are very like fundamental stuffs. But it does fit in a way into a bigger picture. If we think in terms of very like, let's say, low level vision tasks, versus higher level vision tasks. So all these topics of sensing, data representation, and so on, is in a way like the lowest layer. So there's no abstraction at all. The sensing part, topic-wise, goes more into the direction of signal processing. So we're concerned about our signal-to-noise ratio, things like that. No? If we have a specific task, we're interested in contrast-to-noise ratio. But then, like, how can we, like, what do these higher level vision tasks constitute? At the end of the day, we would do something like reconstruct an object from multiple views or so. Yeah. And there's a whole lot of steps in between. Yeah. So for example, 3D reconstruction. Of an object or a building or something. From multiple views. So that is what one would consider a high level vision task. Yeah. So it's a relatively complex way of integrating a lot of visual data. But then there are a couple of steps in between that we need to take in order to get there. And indeed, like, they do build on top of each other. So we do need the sensing part then to start to think about a number of primitives in an image that are interesting to look at. Yeah. So what might be such a primitive? So edges are something like this. We will talk about edges today. Yeah. Corners are another type of primitives. Yeah. And we will use corners, for example, to define then descriptors such that we can re-identify corners, specific points, corner points in multiple images, yeah, and say, okay, these two corners are the same and these two are different corners. Yeah. And this is the basis then to perform some camera calibration and some alignment of multiple views. Which we can use, for example, for something like stereo. This should be a little bit lower than that. Anyways, no? And sooner or later, we will end up there. Yeah. So in a way, we have, if we think of a vision system, there are a whole lot of little problems that we have to solve underway. We have to make a number of design decisions, because like for each of these steps, there are multiple solutions possible. Yeah, so we just have to make a decision here and there in order then to be able to solve more complex tasks. Okay, so this is the big picture that of what we will talk in this lecture, and we will, loosely speaking, we will go from the lower level tasks to the higher level tasks. Okay. So let's start to talk about the edges. The goal of edge detection is to identify some form of discontinuities in an image. And this could be used for recover geometry, recover viewpoints, which is sort of indicated here in this picture. Let me switch off one of the lights. Not this one, this one. So here we have a building with a lot of parallel lines. And if we connect these lines, then we can recover the vanishing points in a scene. Vanishing points are, we did not discuss this yet, but are special points that are associated to perspective projections, as they are done by the typical cameras that we use. Or of course we can use edges as some input to some form of higher level vision tasks, which goes along this reasoning that I've just talked about. Okay, so what effects can be responsible for edges? Here's a list of examples. Maybe what we mean when we talk about edges is a depth discontinuity. Yeah? So we would say it's an occluding contour. It's like a boundary between one object and another object. Yeah, but there are also other types of edges. We can have texture, which can be seen as a surface color discontinuity, like the print on that label. We can have shadow boundaries, which would be an illumination discontinuity. Or we can have differences in surface geometry. So a surface geometry, surface normal discontinuity. And if we look at the projected image, all these effects can lead to edges in the image. Here are a couple of examples. Maybe that's better. Okay, so here's a scene where there are three regions picked out. So this mosaic here, it's an example for a texture discontinuity. No? It's not a real edge. But when you look at it, it does have a strong contrast. Yeah. So if we have an edge detector, it will certainly pick up this edge. Yeah. Here we have an object discontinuity, no? Like an occluding contour. Here we have all kinds of contours. So here's a surface geometry discontinuity, no? Like a surface normal discontinuity. Here's an occluding contour. This is another occluding contour. Here we have a slide. It's not visible here in the beamer. Sorry, there's a slide texture contour there. Oh no, actually, oh no. Looking at this image, it's also an occluding contour. but we barely have any intensity differences here because it's essentially white on white, so we don't really see this. Okay, so these are just examples. Being a little bit more precise, when we talk about edges, we can look at a line profile through an object, and then we either have directly the intensity profile, or what is oftentimes more useful to think about when we think about edges is to look at the first derivative, so the gradient along that contour. And in this case, it would look like something like this. Okay, now let's look back at this example. If we look at the intensity profile along this red line, then we see, okay, so there's a considerable variation in the intensities. See, the value range doesn't exactly go from 0 to 1, but still, like, we see a considerable change in intensities. If we look at the first derivative, then we can see some notable spikes here in the first derivative at the major contours here. Now, you can say, okay, this is all very simple and straightforward. It's also true. It becomes a little bit more complicated when you consider a situation where there is also some noise in the scene, because the derivative operator is quite sensitive to noise. Yeah? If you just repeat the very same example, add a little bit of noise to the image, compute the first derivative, then we already see like the signal is much less clear. Let me go back really quickly. Like we have a relatively clean signal here, as opposed to a more noisy signal here. Yeah? And of course, you can create arbitrary bad cases by adding noise. No, it all depends on your signal to noise ratio, essentially. For example, if we have a step function like this, if we have noise in the derivative, it behaves really badly. And this can lead to situations where your edge like totally vanishes even. Okay, so difference filters and noise don't go very well together. Yeah, but as a matter of fact, we do have to work with noisy images. So the question is, what can we do about it? And the general strategy is to say, okay, let's smooth the image first in order to take out a little bit of the noise and then apply a derivative filter. And so if f is the signal and g is some, for example, Gaussian kernel to apply a little bit of Gaussian smoothing, we convolve the signal with this Gaussian kernel, and we see our edge becomes softer. So this is the price that we have to pay. But other than that, also a lot of the noise is gone. And if we then compute the derivative, we have a good perspective to get a clearer response here. Okay. Now, there's a trick. Instead of saying, okay, we have one function that smooths the image, we have one function that computes the derivative, we can actually do both simultaneously at the same time. And how is this? So we can take the derivative operator into the convolution and so compute the derivative of the convolution kernel G and apply this resulting kernel as one kernel for a convolution with the image F. Yeah, it's sort of like a standard trick in image processing probably had it in intro PR as well. Did you? Yeah. Okay. Right. Okay. So just to have an example here, a Gaussian with a like super primitive type of edge filter here becomes a difference of Gaussian kernel. And then, of course, we can start to play with the parameters, like how many pixel support should our Gaussian have, how many pixel support should our derivative operator have. And that gives us a trade-off between smoothing the image and obtaining a well-localized, crisp edge response at a specific location. And this can be used also at a later state to do some form of multi-resolution decomposition, that we apply filters with different support and then detect edges at different scales. Okay, now let's try to put this into a full edge detector. So what are criteria for a good edge detector? So one thing that we certainly would like to have is that we are indeed quite sensitive to edges, but then we are, at the same time, we have to perform some noise suppression. Yeah. Okay. That is the detection property. The localization property means that we would like to be close to the true edge and that we would like to be unambiguous. Yeah. So it doesn't help to get 5, 6, 7 guesses where the edge is, but we would like to have a clear statement, like a clear guess on the location. Okay. And of course, like, what can we use as an input? Difference in color, intensity, texture. Okay. That is what we have. If we think about the way how probably we knew that we have an edge, there must be an edge. Remember where we had the picture of the building with this edge on the left side that we couldn't see? Like, we used some higher level knowledge, like, okay, if the little house is there in front of the other house, there must be an edge somewhere here. Yeah. So such type of higher level knowledge can, of course, also be used, but we will not talk about methods of this type at this point. Okay. And one way to do it is, okay, so let's create an edge detector that, first of all, returns all edges that are like observable. And then at a higher level vision task, we could have some mechanism to sort out or to distinguish edges that are more useful to our application as opposed to other edges. Okay. Good. So the goal always is to mimic human vision. Yeah. And it's interesting. So humans are really good because I think because they do have also this higher level notion of objects. Yeah. For example, when you look at the Berkeley segmentation database with annotations by humans, then what the edges that humans select, they are essentially oriented along object boundaries. But humans don't care so much about, for example, the shadow at the shirt there or so. No, they just don't necessarily consider this as a relevant edge. Hmm? And the difference between those two can be seen here when we look at the raw gradient magnitude as computed, maybe with the Sobel operator or so from last time. Okay. Now, the interesting thing is, if we measure the performance of an actual human operator on annotating edges in an image, and we look at the like sort of performance of various edge detectors. It's a long-standing problem, yeah? And even though, beyond any doubt, like vision has made big advances and still does it, it's not the case that in general the machine is as good as humans are. Yeah? It always depends on how you choose your playing field, but I thought this is a really an interesting statistic. So the field is sort of moving towards human performance, but we are not there yet. Okay. So what we will look at today is the Kenny edge detector. Yeah. And we will come to this in a second. What it does is it essentially is a local edge operator. So it says, okay, here this looks like an edge and that looks like an edge. And then it has some, yeah, not too complicated reasoning component to say like, okay, if here's an edge and here's an edge, maybe I can also connect the space in between and then obtain a continuous contour. That is how it works. So it starts out with local edge detection and then extends it to longer contours. Yeah, we will not consider or discuss learning-based methods in this class. So there's still room for improvement for that. Okay. Good. So the Kenny edge detector, it's an old method. It's from 1986. It's super well known. Like you cannot claim you took a vision class without knowing about the Kenny edge detector, because that will like immediately sort of show, okay, you did not really take this vision class. No? okay, and the so there's also a theoretical derivation to this, but we're not going into this. Okay, so here's an example image. So let's say we have a color image as input, but let's only consider the grayscale version of that image. Then we start out with a normal like edge detection that we compute the derivatives of a smoothed image. And we combine this into one kernel, so we compute the derivatives of a Gaussian. We already saw this operator in x and y direction, and we obtain two output images that look like this. Then we look for the magnitude and the orientation of the gradient. So you can probably not perceive it well here, but the brightness values encode the magnitude of the gradients here. Magnitude is just in a Euclidean sense the sum of the squares of the gradients in x and y direction, and the gradient orientation is computed from the relative magnitude of the gradient in x and y direction. And here color-coded, so the angle is color-coded in this map. Okay, then in order to achieve this requirement of localizing an edge, a non-maximum suppression is performed. Non-maximum suppression means if we look at a line perpendicular to the actual edge, then we only keep that one edge pixel which has the highest magnitude, and we dispose of the other edge pixels around in the neighborhood. So this changes the edge response from a relatively blurry result to a very like a one pixel type of result. Okay, and then there's this trick to link segments of edges into larger larger pieces, which is called hysteresis thresholding. And the way it is done is this. So the Kenny edge detector requires the user to define two thresholds. So one threshold that is relatively high, if we have an edge response that is above this threshold, we say, oh, we are sure that this is really an edge. Yeah. And then we have a lower threshold where we say, okay, everything that is below this lower threshold, this cannot be an edge. Yeah. It's just too low. Okay. And the edge elements that are between those two thresholds are used to link segments of high thresholds. Yeah. So if we have two segments with that are above the high threshold, then we are looking for a path that changes the curvature as little as possible to actually link those segments. Yeah. That is the whole idea. Now, when we think about so we have to set these thresholds sort of manually, yeah. So that's sort of a drawback, no? But that is the idea, right? Okay, and then it's hard to see here, but then you obtain an image that has relatively nice contours, and little noise in general. Okay, so we have as parameters we have the high and the low edge threshold, and certainly we have the the smoothing kernel that we applied in the beginning, yeah, and these are the three components that can be used to influence our result, obtain less edges if we use a stronger smoothing operator, or obtain more edges if we have a smaller smoothing kernel here. Okay, so here's everything on one page. So we filter the image, compute magnitude and orientation, thin out our gradients with the non-maximum suppression, and then link gradient segments with this hysteresis thresholding. Of course, it is implemented in MATLAB. It's also implemented in, I think, probably all other vision frameworks. Okay, so that's on edge detection. Then I would like to talk about corners. Okay, have you heard about Kenny in Introduction to Pattern Recognition? Probably not. You did? Okay, so then it's not a big surprise or something. Yeah? Corner detection is probably also something that is sort of known, but it's in a way it's more important than the edges, because we will build on these corners the descriptors and then do all the other stuff based on that. Yeah, so this one is mission critical for the rest of the lecture. So we're going to talk about properties of good interest points, Harris corners, and then like invariance or covariance of these Harris corners. And it sort of lines up, okay, filtering the edges and corners, that enables the higher vision tasks. So, so in order to work with features, defining the corners or detecting the corners is the first step to do. Then we need a way of describing these corners such that we can say two corners are identical or are different. That's the description. And then, of course, corners need to be matched such that we get into the situation that we can align multiple views showing the same part of a scene, for example. Okay, and this actually has a couple of applications. I have a number of slides here on applications. So, so what tasks can be addressed with that? So with this type of primitive. So one thing is image alignment. For example, if our task is to stitch multiple images to one large panorama, yeah, then we need, essentially, we only need two components. We need such a feature description and matching pipeline such that we know how these images align to each other. And then we need a blending routine because, for example, the brightness may differ a little bit between the images. So we need to have some strategy to blend one image over another, yeah? But that's all. And then we can create panorama images. 3D reconstruction, certainly. Motion tracking, when we think of the change between one and the next picture as a change of either another object that moves past, or if we think of ego motion of a robot or so, then the whole scene changes because the camera is moving. Okay, then of course, all the image retrieval type of tasks that you make a query, similar to the Google image search, for example, that you like to have pictures of New York, no? And then, oh, similar, like show me similar pictures to this. So this type of requests, and of course, object recognition also quite directly by considering histograms of feature points, for example. Okay, so here's a little bit more concrete example that also gives an indication how these feature points, so why they should be robust a little bit and why the correspondence matching is so important. For example, we have a picture of a stop sign here. And if we look at essentially the same sign, but only from a slightly different perspective, then we see the differences between those two cutouts are not so large, but still, like a naive template matching would probably give a very bad result. Yeah, but instead, if we consider these pictures as collections of interest points, then we can say, okay, the letter T, for example, it has a number of interest points in a certain relationship, and it's white on red, and then it's much easier to say, okay, this and this is actually quite similar. It only differs by some rotation. Yeah. So for establishing correspondences between views, a robust key point representation actually helps. Okay, here's another example. We will talk about the alignment of two views with the goal of computing depth then. And we also use key points in order to match them onto each other. And the same sort of exercise, but at a much larger scale, can be done if we consider, for example, this project. It received a lot of attention. The paper was called Building Rome in a Day. And what the authors did is that they, I think they collected from Flickr or so, a number of images that gave results on the search term Colosseum in Rome. So then they had, I don't know how many images, a lot, like in the 100,000s or millions. And then what they did is that they found a relatively quick way of aligning all these images to each other, although they didn't control the camera or anything. So these were images from other persons. And over a large variety of cameras and lighting conditions and so on and so on. So they found alignments between these images and used this then to reconstruct the Colosseum from these images. Now this was, I forgot what year this was, probably 2008 or 9 or so. And it took a big compute cluster to perform this reconstruction. And then a year later, there was a paper, Building Rome on a Cloudless Day, which essentially did the same task, but on a GPU instead of in a compute cloud. So they thought of a couple of tricks how to dramatically speed this up and to bring it efficiently on a graphics card and then reconstructed the Colosseum. Okay. Other tasks or other examples, of course, that also implies some requirements. So if we say we're trying to re-identify an object that reappears in a different scene, then we might want to have some invariance to appearance, like the brightness, illumination of the scene, but also to the geometry. So if the object is rotated or scaled, for example. And it's not really clear from the beginning how to achieve this. So we will talk about this. Yeah, we already talked about the panorama stitching example. Okay, so considering these examples, let's create a list of requirements for good features that we would like them to satisfy. So one thing is that we want them to have some repeatability. So the same feature shall be found in several images despite geometric and photometric transformations. Then saliency, meaning that we are able to distinguish one feature point from another feature point. So a feature representation itself is distinctive. Then we would like to have a certain compactness, of course, because we always have our computational constraints. and then certainly we also would like to have locality. So that means that a feature point refers to a relatively small portion of the image, such that we have accurate information so to what region it refers to. Okay. So here's an example. for the repeatability task. So if in one image we have those four feature points, in the other image we have those four feature points, then we cannot establish a match between those two images. Here's another example for the distinctiveness. So assume we have a number of false matches, but we also do have correspondences that are actually true matches. Yeah. Then we see that distinctiveness is actually quite important, because then it allows us to indeed identify this point with that point and discard the other options that we would have to match it, particularly in scenes where the scene itself looks actually quite similar or is not distinctive in terms of, let's say, colors or frequencies or so. Yeah. Okay. So we will talk here about the feature detection first. So to find a set of distinctive key points. So the basic idea is that we can determine, okay, we don't know where we will find a feature again. But what we can compute is that we look at different regions in the image and compute a score how certain we can be that we will find it again. And that is actually what makes corners so interesting, because it's going to turn out that corners are features that are relatively distinct in a scene. And other features like edges or flat surfaces or so, there are always ambiguities about their location. Okay, and the approach to compute this stability is to compare an image patch with shifted versions of itself, yeah? So against its local neighbors. So here's an illustration of this. If we would like to locate this image patch, we wouldn't have a chance at all, because it is part of a flat area, so it can be anywhere here. If we just say it's a black area, no? If we look at a patch along a corner, it could be anywhere here, no? Along an edge, it could be anywhere here. But if we have an edge at a corner, then it's relatively distinct, so there's not much possibility to wobble around in an image. And how can we identify such a corner? The specific property about a corner is that it changes its intensity, so it has intensity gradients in X and Y direction. Yeah. Also, when we rotate it by 45 degrees, this in principle doesn't change. So then it's sort of a change in both diagonal directions, an intensity difference. Okay. So so these corners are found with the so-called Harris corner detector. And there's like a mathematical background to it that links to the autocorrelation of an image patch. So what is the autocorrelation? Autocorrelation is just the correlation of an image with itself. And here we say, okay, within a small image window. Now, if we consider an edge, if we consider different edge locations in the image, and look at the autocorrelation response of these regions, then, for example, a flat area here is pretty much correlated with itself, because no matter where you shift it, it's always the same signal. When you look at an edge area here, I have a mouse pointer here. Sorry. If you look at an edge area here and look at the response of the autocorrelation function, then it will essentially reflect that edge. Because if you move that patch along the edge, it's always highly correlated to itself. But if you move it away from the edge, then it's not correlated. Yeah? Okay. And we can look at the profile of this function. So what we see here is an elongated sort of valley or so of that autocorrelation function. Okay, and now if we look at the third point, that is somewhere here on the grass, hard to recognize on that picture, but okay, that is somewhere here on the grass, then it turns out if we move the window a little bit, we lose our autocorrelation. So in that sense, this point is quite distinct because small shifts already lead to different intensity distribution. So the autocorrelation function has a small, like a very narrow valley here within a larger area, a larger surface. Okay. So that could be used directly as a cue. Yeah, we could compute the autocorrelation of an image with a certain window size and then look for locations where we have these very distinct peaks. However, it's not exactly done like this for some reasoning about the computational cost, yeah, because it would just be a very expensive operation, yeah, but this is the underlying idea of this corner detector. So the Harris corner detector, how does it work? It says, yeah, okay, in principle, if we look for something that has a little drop off here, a function that has a little drop off here, then it's similar. I mean, loosely speaking, it's similar to looking for a function that has about this shape. Yeah. So we look for an autocorrelation that roughly has this quadratic shape. Okay, and then there are a number of technical details that are performing a Taylor series expansion on the derivatives of an image. So the goal of all this is to avoid to evaluate the autocorrelation function directly. And so this leads to so performing the Taylor expansion, here we have the zeroth order, first order, second order term of the Taylor expansion. So the local quadratic approximation of EUV in the neighborhood of 0, 0 is given by the second order Taylor expansion. That means we expand this term and we drop those two and only consider the second derivative here as the item of interest. So this is what eventually will be something like the key feature for detecting the corners. So we end up with approximating this autocorrelation function as a quadratic function with around a matrix M, which essentially consists of the derivatives in X and Y direction. Okay, so in terms of computation or so, it's not complicated. So it's nothing that we haven't seen before. The derivative in X direction, it's a normal derivative in Y direction also. And the derivative X, Y essentially applies both operators. Okay, now the interesting thing is this. Let me jump here. So if we, so let's say we compute, we locally approximate the autocorrelation by such a function, then we can say if we set this identical to a constant value, it's like looking at a slice through this function. And this is actually an ellipsis. And this finally, okay, there's an illustration of these ellipses first. No, let me talk about this slide first. So this finally brings us to the actual Harris-Kornner detector. So because an ellipsis mathematically is characterized by, can be characterized by its eigenvalues. So lambda 1, lambda 2. And so the smaller, so if we take the larger eigenvalue to the power of minus 1/2, so 1 over square root of largest eigenvalue is the diameter, the smaller diameter of this ellipsis, and the same argument for the other eigenvalue for the larger side of that ellipsis. Yeah? And this is sort of the key feature that identifies the distribution or the type of edge that we are actually looking at. Let's have a look at this example right now. So here's a, so let's say this would be our situation here of these second moment matrices. Now let's have a look at the resulting ellipses that we obtain. So so what can be seen relatively easily is that these ellipses align with the like edge structure of that image. Yeah. What can also be seen is that if you have a flat area, these ellipses more or less vanish. And if we have areas where, if we have like nicely shaped areas like this point here, we have a relatively circular ellipsis indeed. But here, for example, at an edge, along the edge, all these ellipses are quite elongated. Yeah? Okay. And the whole idea is now to say, okay, I use these two eigenvalues to find out what the shape and the size of my ellipsis is, and this will be an indication on whether I have a corner, an edge, or a flat area. Okay, and this can be drawn in such a diagram. So if we have a flat area, and here on the x and y axis we have the magnitude of the eigenvalues. If we have a flat area, both first and second eigenvalue are really small. If one eigenvalue is considerably larger than the other one, then we are here close to one of the axes. That means that we do have an edge. And if both eigenvalues are large and approximately of the same order of magnitude, then we can say, oh, this looks like a corner, so like a point that we can further use. Okay, mathematically, we can set up a corner-ness criterion by saying, okay, so let's define a corner-ness criterion C, where we relate the product of the two eigenvalues to the squared sum of those two eigenvalues, yeah, multiplied with some scaling factor. And what that essentially means is, okay, the product of the eigenvalues, this is the same thing like the determinant of a matrix A, if lambda 1 and 2 are the eigenvalues of matrix A, and the sum of the eigenvalues is the same like the trace of that matrix. So that means we don't even need to explicitly compute these eigenvalues, but we only need to compute the determinant of M. So this was the matrix of derivatives in X and Y direction, minus the trace of M. And that will give this Cornerness criterion C. If C is larger than zero, we say, oh, this is a corner. If it's lower than zero, it's an edge. And if it's in general small, then we don't consider it also because it's a flat area. Okay. So okay, so to sum things up, so we can say in principle, looking at the local autocorrelation is a reasonable measure to determine how much wiggle space we have for one specific image feature, but we do not want to compute it directly. Instead, say, okay, let's not look at the autocorrelation directly, but at the second moment matrix of the image, and let's compute. So, and then in principle, the eigenvalues could indicate us the cornerness of that image region, but we don't even need to compute those. We can also just compute the determinant and trace of that matrix M. Okay, so here's a more algorithmic approach to stating the very same. So we have an input image, compute the image derivatives, compute this matrix M, which is just squaring the derivatives, apply our smoothing to deal with the noise, and then compute determinant minus trace and threshold on C to pick high cornerness. So it's a very quick thing actually to implement. Okay, and then there's a technical detail again. Let's perform a non-maximum suppression, because if we have a slightly larger corner, we will get multiple responses in that corner area. Okay, so here just some examples. Example input image. Here's a raw output image of the cornerness score C. And then we do the thresholding, which leaves us with the red areas only. And then we do the non-maximum suppression. Okay, you don't see anything, but we have isolated points here. And they can be, of course, projected back or overlaid onto the image, and it give a visual impression what this approach sort of considers to be stable points that are likely to be re-identified. Here's an interesting detail. This is a specularity that comes probably from the flashlight of the camera or so. And this is actually a notorious example. If we are dealing with multiple views, then the specularities always change their position, no? Because, well, we're looking at it from a different perspective. No? So this is something where, like a source of noise in our key points that we always sort of buy with the scene. Yeah. So even if we would have perfect noise suppression and so on in an individual image, This is something that comes then from the fact that we are dealing with multiple views, which will always introduce some spurious key points, for example. Okay. So a couple of notes on the invariance that we achieve essentially with these corners. So, so are these locations that we obtain, are they invariant to photometric transformations and covariant to geometric photometric transformations and covariant to geometric transformations? So what does this mean? So invariance to photometric transformations means, what if the image is a little bit darker when we take a picture of it the second time? That would be a typical photometric transformation, yeah? Or what about this specularity? Okay, that's a bad one, but still, no? What about this, no? So invariant means, can we still detect the same key points, although, for example, the brightness or other photometric conditions changed? Covariance means, can we still detect the key points? then, so if we are covariant to geometric transformations, can we still detect the key points if our geometry is a little bit different? Okay, so let's think about these points a little bit. So what if brightness changes? Yeah, we can save. Let's make this assumption that we have an affine transformation of the image brightnesses. Yeah, so an image intensity I becomes AI plus B. And the interesting thing is, since we're operating on intensities, we don't really care about the offset. Yeah, so the offset B doesn't matter at all. It's the first thing that is dropped off. Yeah, the A is a scaling factor, so that might have some impact. If we think about our threshold C, the Cornaness threshold C, then it could be that if we crank up the brightness, that we accidentally get over this threshold just by increasing the overall value range of our data. Okay, what about translation? Turns out we don't care about translation at all, because all we did is shift invariant, yeah? So translation is not a problem. What about rotation of the image? So when we think about this argument that the distribution of the autocorrelation can essentially be represented with such an ellipse, then rotation does not really matter, yeah? Because we decomposed the shape of the ellipse. Sorry, I think I was jumping over this. We decomposed it into a rotational part and the eigenvalues. So we had something like EUV equals R to the minus one, and then we have lambda one, lambda two, R. Okay, so rotation doesn't matter, because it doesn't affect our eigenvalues. We could just change the rotation matrix and still have the same eigenvalues. So we're totally invariant to rotation. Okay, scaling is actually a problem. So we're not scale invariant in any way, no? Because we're looking at a local neighborhood. If suddenly this becomes much larger or much smaller, then from our perspective, just like we're looking at a new image, no? If we have significant scaling. And this is, in a way, a weakness of the Harris-Connor detector that, yeah, can be addressed with other approaches. Okay. So how can we find the right scale of an interest point? And that will directly bring us to the SIFT feature detector. And then later, so certainly next week, we will also talk about feature matching. Okay, so let's see where we are in this overview. So we said the Harris key point detector, it's good for detecting points, indeed. We did not talk about description yet. So that is what the SIFT descriptor, for example, will be good for in order to distinguish different points. Okay, so we left off at a point that we said, okay, the Harris-Connor detector is doing a great job. It also has a nice theoretical underpinning and so on. But what can we do about the scale? Because we're not scale covariant. And here's an example, actually, from a benchmark data set. Here's an example image. Let's say we have one version of that image at this scale and then a zoomed in version of the same image. And how can we achieve this situation that we say, okay, we look at some function of some image representation that gives us the same value independent of the scale at which we are looking at an image. So how to find patch sizes at which F response is equal? What is a good function F? So I think there's not a super satisfying solution to this, but here's one way how this can be done. And it's done like this also in practice. So you can say, okay, I have this function f, which still needs to be defined, and I evaluate this function at different scales in the image. Yeah? For example, I could rescale the image again and again and re-execute it, yeah, at the same location, and then look at the responses of my function f. And then I say, okay, the actual scale of my image is the location where this function is maximum. Yeah. So that is the scale at which I would like to compute then my descriptor afterwards, for example, and also would like to perform matching of descriptors. Later on. Okay, now we need to talk about a little bit more concrete about a choice for this signature function f. Yeah? You could say, okay, why not again start with our Gaussian? No? We have the Gaussian, we have the first derivative, we have the Laplacian of Gaussian. And probably the Laplacian of Gaussian indeed is the most common choice for this task. So it's a so-called blob detector. So just a quick reminder, Laplacian of Gaussian means we have a Gaussian function convolved with a derivative operator. So we have again, a combination of smoothing and derivative. Yeah? And we can parameterize the Laplacian of Gaussian at different scales, depending on what smoothing kernel size and what derivative kernel size we pick. So this would detect like very little blobs or larger blobs then, and evaluate, so use the Laplacian of Gaussian to evaluate that function. Let me close the window, sorry, because I'm sort of distracted. Okay, so the approach is fairly straightforward. So we take these different these kernels of different sizes, convolve the image with it over and over again. So for example, we increase the standard deviation always by one, or we multiply it by something. And then we pick a region and evaluate our filter response there. And then we pick the maximum response. Yeah? And that would be the scale, like the optimum scale for this area. Okay. Another essentially equivalent approach, instead of taking the Laplacian of Gaussian, is to take a difference of Gaussians. So you have a Gaussian with one standard deviation and a second Gaussian of another standard deviation. Like here, the green one is the wider one, the red one is the more narrow one, and you subtract them from each other, and you see the resulting shape is actually quite similar to a Laplacian of Gaussians. And that the nice property with this is that since you're convolving the image anyways multiple times with different kernel sizes, then you can also take your intermediate results and subtract them from each other. That automatically gives you a difference of Gaussian, and then perform the same type of evaluation of looking at the specific position and looking for the maximum. So this is really like essentially the same slide as before. So should be clear, yeah? Input image, Gaussian with standard deviation, one sigma, you subtract them, obtain this response. You filter it again, subtract those two, filter it again, subtract those two, and so on and so on. Okay, and yeah, here's just an example result. These types of images are oftentimes seen in papers like proposing new feature descriptors or so. So here the little cross indicates the position at which this scaling function was evaluated, and then the magnitude of the circle indicates at what scale the filter bank gave the maximum response. No? And so, for example, here we have this little ridge, so a small scale already sufficed. No, here we have an interesting situation because so we have the eye here, no, and so a slightly off center of the eye, a smaller filter was chosen, but right in the center of the eye, a larger filter was chosen. No, okay, but of course, like not all of these results are nicely explicable by image content. I mean, this certainly also noise and everything in the evaluation. Okay. Good. One application, one direct application of this idea is the so-called maximally stable extremal regions method, which defines areas in the image that are that do not change across a lot of these scale parameters. So that means, or if we briefly go back, so if we have an area here that gives a consistently high response, yeah, could be okay, the maximum is here, but it doesn't really fall off quickly, yeah, as opposed to maybe some other areas that show more like such a behavior. Yeah. Okay. So let's say we have here an area where, so on the x-axis again, sorry, we have the scale. No? We look at the image at different scales. We reevaluate our function f. So, and here we have an image area where f leads to a consistently high response. Yeah. Then this is a sort of maximally stable extremal region. MSER. So it's not exactly a corner point, yeah, because it's a it can really be a region, no? Like a whole letter, for example, if you have something written there, no? Or it can be some homogeneous area, for example, no? Larger homogeneous area. So it's not a corner point, but it's like a larger blob where the filter response doesn't change. And it's also something that has been proposed with the purpose of being re-recognizable across multiple views. So here's an example. So here are a couple of maximally stable extremal regions shown. So here's another view. And now we could start to match one region with another region, no? Like, for example, this one here is actually nicely preserved here, no? Or here, this eye, no? It's nicely preserved here. But still, it's not a key point. So still the question a little bit open, like, how can I actually match this? So there's still something missing, no? It's not so 100% clear. Please.
The x-axis, you mentioned that we look at images in different scales. But images you meant like Bata images, like the difference of the Gaussian.
Yes.
But you also mentioned about these homogeneous regions. How is it possible that we can have like homogeneous regions? Are you so early imaging that when we apply the Gaussian and subtract from the input, would be homogeneous regions in the Bata?
Yes, right, they will not, right. So in that sense, you would not expect a high response in a fully homogeneous region. That's yes, right. Thank you for bringing this up. Yeah, that's actually true. What I had in mind, I'm always thinking from the direction of the key points. And a key point needs a corner. Okay, like we need something like this, no? For a key point. And this is not the case for a maximally stable region. Yeah. Okay. So we could, I mean, okay, if you just look at this example, no? We can have quite irregular shapes. Okay, so let's maybe limit ourselves to a statement like this. We can have quite irregular shapes, but these shapes indeed are regions. So, which is also the thing that sort of why they are called like this, no? But you're right. Thinking of it in terms of frequencies, it cannot be a like just a flat area. No? That wouldn't make any sense. Okay. All right. So to wrap the interest points up. So what we would like to achieve, or what we need for our higher vision tasks, is to have some detector that leads to a repeatable selection of regions or areas, and that allows to compute a distinctive like descriptor on it. So we talked about the corners, and then of course we saw there are also alternatives, like for example using these maximally stable extremal regions. Okay. So why are we looking at different interest point detectors and with what goals? So one is certainly we need a number of good matches. Yeah. So we can. So the choice of the detector is certainly a point that is relatively important, because it's early on in our pipeline, on top of which we build our algorithm. But then still, it might be worth to think about the actual purpose. So why we are looking, what we are specifically looking for. For example, if we need a precise location or so, then we should operate with something like a corner detector, like the Harris corner detector. If robustness to scale differences is important, then we should employ some mechanism like these differences of Gaussians or so, or just, I did not really go into the details here, but just to have you aware that there are also features that extend across whole regions, like, for example, these maximally stable extremal regions. Okay, and then like a reply that is so often said, like, okay, it depends on the application, what we would like to achieve. And yeah, okay. So because feature detectors play such an important role as a building block, there has also been done a lot of work on this, no? And here are, for example, references to evaluation papers by Mikulajczyk and others that compare a lot of these detectors. Okay. Yeah, so here's a table out of that work. You can see here's a whole list of alternatives, no? The plain Harris feature detector, but also variants of the Harris feature detector, like Harris plus some Laplace filter, Harris plus some affine patch to be invariant to affine transformations, and so on. And then what criteria do we have? So we can either have a detector that is sensitive to corners, we can have a detector that is sensitive to blobs, we can have a detector that is sensitive to regions. And then the requirements that we discussed, like, are we rotation invariant? Okay, everyone is rotation invariant because rotation is just such a common thing. No? Then second question, are we scale invariant? No? Scale is also a common problem, so most of them are. Here, invariant affine transformations, I think that is already a little bit more of a specific requirement, but nevertheless, I mean, it's commonly faced actually also as a task. Okay, and then here's some assessment by the authors on the repeatability, localization, accuracy, robustness, and computational efficiency. Okay, so they're just saying like there's a lot of prior work, and when it comes to that you need more information there, then you can look at this. Okay, now okay, we're not going to talk about descriptors anymore, but next week, indeed. Just let me pull this one slide up. So now we have seen there are a number of alternatives for detecting specific image regions in an image. Yeah, I think the most important one indeed are the corner detectors. But there are also other ones like the blobs or the region detectors. Okay, we will continue. Essentially, we will continue using these corner detectors and think about effective descriptors such that we can match image regions and talk a little bit about matching criteria. Okay, and once we have this, Then we actually go into the geometric part of the computer vision, start to work with cameras, calibrate them, and look at multi-view geometry. Okay, thank you.